counted among the outlaws, he said, "Come, follow me." People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.
Why are past matters more than we think? Or does it? It's a topic for today. I don't know. Are we talking about the historical past, the beginning of the universe, America's past, or our personal past? I think they all matter to some degree, but coming from a Christian's perspective, we're taught, and it's theologically true, that when you accept Christ, you become a new creation. All things are gone. Behold, all things are new. And is there a dilemma, though, in that all things are new and that we can't reflect on the past if we need to? Do we still have wounds that need to be healed? Do we still need, is there value in our past life, not in our former life, but in our life before Christ? Our experiences, the things we've said, the things we've done, the interactions, the relationships we have, friends and family, and this or that as life goes on, do those hold value still in our lives today? And if so, what? I have someone who would be much more articulate than myself to unpack that we have here today, Dr. John Arthur Nunes. He is currently the pastor at Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Santa Monica, California. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy and the dean and lecturer at Camp Arcadia in Arcadia, Michigan. He was formerly the president of Concordia College in New York. He was born in Jamaica and raised in Canada, and he's been a resident in the U.S. since 1981. He also served as the president and the CEO of Lutheran World Relief and was the president of Valparaiso University and an inner city pastor in both Dallas and Detroit. He's also an author. His books include Wittenberg, Meets the World, Reimagining the Reformation from the Margins, and more recently, Meant for More, In, With, and Under the Ordinary. John is married to his wife, Monique, and they have 6 children, 11 grandchildren, and they lead a consulting group, Nunes and Associates. And thank you for joining me, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Ken, for the welcome and for the introduction and for sporting that Tigers hat, since we can celebrate today that the Anaheim Angels, I think, beat them last night here in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Get another chance today.
Right. Nothing like baseball. So this topic. I don't know. Maybe one, you know, I didn't think much about it until we discussed talking about this. Or I haven't thought about it with a theological spin, a religious spin, a Christian spin. And we're always taught, like I said, and it's true, that we become a new creation. All things are past. But then when we have trials in life or traumas in life or just getting into relationships, and you do marriage counseling. Actually, ironically, you do Christian marriage counseling, and what do? They make you bring up your past and your past relationships so you can learn from them and not duplicate them, or how you can spot them in other people or whatever. Is that duplicity, or how do we unpack that?
Yeah, you've really framed this well, Ken, the complexity, you know, as Christians who are new creations, behold, the old is gone. But what does that mean? I mean, is it really gone? Is the old really gone? I once read someone who said, you know, that in the water of baptism and when you're saved, that the old self, the old Adam, is drowned in that water of baptism. But he's a really good swimmer, and he kind of just crawls and creeps his way back into your life. So at the end of the day, you know, the past is something we have to deal with. I mean, I guess there are a variety of unhealthy responses we can have to the past. We can live in or try to live in the past, or engage in nostalgia about the past. The writer of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verse 10, Solomon, says that that's not a wise thing to do, to say that the good old days were good. We can talk more about this as we converse today. The other thing we can let the past do, I guess, is haunt us, and we can live under the kind of shadow of the past. And I guess the other unhealthy response would be to not pay attention to the lessons we can learn from the pasts, from our pasts. So there are, I guess, three unhealthy ways we can think about the past. So I think your framing is exactly right. The past matters more than we think.
Yeah. And along with what you're saying, so if you were to not think about it, if you were to think about our past, like we know history, which is, if you forget history and you don't look at the past, you're doomed to repeat it. Is that the same?
Yeah, George Santayana, the historian, said that. Yeah, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. Yeah,
that's it's like an inevitable thing. So does that translate to humans? I mean, to like our personal past. If we don't address it, if we're not self-aware enough to look at and self-evaluate our behavior, we'll just continue that behavior.
That's exactly right. And own it and come to terms with it. Early theologian named St. Augustine once described it this way. He said, sin is not the desire that we have or the desires that we have had, but it is the disordering of those desires. So one of the ways we can learn from the past, to your point, is to learn about and come to terms with, and to use your expression, be self-aware about what our own tendencies are, what our own proclivities and propensities are, what our own vices are, and flip those on their head and turn them into virtues. So for example, you know, Ken, you're a very charismatic individual. You have a great personality. People like you when they meet you. And you can use that personality for positive ways, or you can use it for negative ways. And as you look
both.
And as you look at your past, you can see the way in which you have maybe used that charming personality that you have for some negative ways, and then learn from that and get that desire more rightly ordered, is what Augustine is calling us to do.
Yeah. So if I were to examine myself, I wouldn't have come up with the word charming, but just in your example of myself, if I were to say, okay, I have these attributes, a self-examination, here's some pros, here's some cons.
Yep.
Here's how the pros could be cons.
Yep.
And then to have enough, is it self-awareness and courage to say, here's how I've actually misused my pros? Because if you don't do that, I think you have to call yourself out, right? Is that a way to put it?
Well, that's just really well said. You know, our sunny side and our shadow side are related. So some of this, when you come to Christ, it's not like you lose your mind, okay, or you lose your personality, or you lose your the person that God created you to be. Yeah. It's that mind and that personality and that person you are created to be is now in a redeemed state. So it's now your desires are rightly ordered. Your thoughts are rightly redeemed and are used for the kind of purposes that God has in mind for you. You have a new sort of creativity because you've learned from your past and from past errors. Someone once said that the historically lobotomized have nothing with which to be creative. In other words, if you want to think outside of the box, you got to know what's inside of the box. And if you want to have a creative future, you got to know what's inside of your own kind of toolkit, your own box. So yeah, I think the term you used rightly and wisely is kind of a self-awareness about the gifts that God has given to you.
And I think in myself and just like what I call the Christian culture, church going and families going to Bible studies and retreats, and it's just part of their life. Where, how can I put this? Behavior, self-behavior versus an internal change. So when I think of becoming new, I think of all the sins have been washed away. My spirit's been reborn from a kingdom of darkness to a kingdom of light. There's still darkness in the world. I still have the flesh. I still have the same desires and this and that. I now have the tools to get through life in a better way. But those who don't understand feel like, maybe I'll say from the inside and the outside. So from the outside looking at, I would get feedback, probably not as much as I should, but it's like, well, you say you're a Christian and you still act this way, or why would you do that? And people that aren't, you claim to be a Christian and then do it publicly, and then you're easily labeled a hypocrite and things like this. And it's yeah, of course I am. Because what a Christian is, what I say that I am, is that I'm so flawed. Yeah. I need a savior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where I think sometimes, so I'm all of those things. I'm grasping onto this because of what I actually am.
That's right.
And I think in the church sometimes where the hypocrisy feel comes from are people who are trying to act like they're Christ, and as opposed to allowing Christ to live through them as sinful creatures.
That's, again, you know, you nail it. You remind me of what C.S. Lewis once said. Someone once asked C.S. Lewis, what about that guy over there? He claims he's a Christian. Look how like grumpy and grouchy he is all the time. How could he be a Christian? And C.S. Lewis said, can you imagine how much grumpier and grouchier he'd be if he weren't a Christian? there is something around us owning our personality and being authentic about our personality, and taking the time to engage in self-examination of who we are. And I think one of the things that goes wrong in our culture is we are surrounded always by the clutter and the clatter of noise and technology and distraction, ceaseless distraction. And in a culture of distraction, we don't carve out the time sufficient to disconnect ourselves and detach ourselves from our false loves and to clear out that clatter in order that we can hear God speak to us in a new way.
Yeah. See if you can help me. So you mentioned time a lot. We all know what time it is. So time is how we mark a beginning and end, right? It's a measurement of living, or how many times we breathe in an amount. I don't know exactly a definition for time, but we know how we use it. It's a measurement of time, someplace we can be and then leave, and it's a track keeper. Would you say we are made up of, as human beings, I guess DNA, right? We're biological creatures that have some kind of genetic code that enables us to be functioning, and our brains, well, just functioning, and the fact that we can sit and hear each other and try to understand and come to think, we're just humans through DNA. Then the second is time too broad? Are we made up of time? Can time be everything? So I've lived 53 plus years. That's my time. Was that just a measurement, or is my 53 years, is time fall under the accumulation of my upbringing, of the values instilled in me, every conversation I've ever had, anything I've done or said secretly or privately? I think about scripture that says every word you've spoken, you know, is recorded. good or bad kind of thing. Like everything is, God's outside of time, but is that a measurement of time where he's saying everything, not like Santa Claus, I'm watching you, good or bad. It's every bit of your movement that DNA has produced for you has created who you are in this time, which is really our life experience. That doesn't get washed away. Then how can you move forward in time with plans, dreams, ambitions, anything healthy, and disregard everything that is my 53 years of time and just start as if I'm an emotional infant?
Well, I thought you said you weren't a philosopher. That sounded very philosophical there. So time is inescapable. And yet, if you ask anyone to define time, most people can't. I mean, what at the end of the day is time? You hinted at it. You said it's a unit of measuring our life experience. But the past really doesn't exist, Augustine would say, because it's past. The future doesn't really exist because it hasn't arrived yet. And the present doesn't really exist, because as soon as you say something or do something, it's immediately past. So time abstractly does not exist, but relatively in terms of our experience, it does. And you're right, we're kind of bound to time. You know, aging is a good clue that we're kind of bound to this thing called time.
It's a love and hate relationship with aging.
We do, yeah. Isn't it interesting that God identifies God's own self as I am that I am? Jesus shows up and he does the same thing. He says, you know, I am the bread of life. I am the way, truth, and the life. I am the true vine, all of his so-called I am sayings. So Jesus co-opts for himself a term with respect to time that is in an eternal present tense.
Yes.
Kind of interesting.
It is interesting. Can I add to that, that, and then when it refers to us, it always uses the word today when it instructs us. Today is the day of salvation, or today when you hear his voice. I think that's the closest we can get to I am. We're not the I am, but he's living in an alternate, in some kind of state of continual present. And I think that is the closest we can understand of being outside of time, right? He's living outside of time. And then I think our spiritual life is kind of outside of time. The most spiritual moments I've ever had felt like you were outside of time.
Yeah, it's when time stops. You know, it's when you lose track of time, when you're in the zone. That's when you're in, to describe what you're describing, these spiritual moments. One of the points I want to make today is we have to be intentional about carving out time and space and place for those moments to happen, because our world, again, has overwhelmed us with a barrage of noise and relationships and connections and responsibilities. And our souls find it difficult to find rest.
So along those lines, you are the Lutheran tradition, which is liturgical in by its nature. If that's fair to say, right?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So in a culture that is turning, you know, more towards the spiritualism than anything else, than religion, anyways. But even within the Christian realm, there's a pull away from denominationalism, Baptist, Presbyterian, Lutheranism. What would you say from your perspective, as a Lutheran minister who appreciates and understands the value of a liturgical practice, what would you add into that cultural conversation of besides, like, something can feel warm and like home if you grew up in something and you just like to do that same kind of tradition. But what is the value of the liturgy in a social setting of communal worship? I don't think I'm taking it outside the question because
you're good. This is golden. This is golden. I like this a lot, Ken. So just 2 points. I agree with you 100%. In fact, I just posted recently on social media that I believe that denominations are done per se. Not that the church is done. The church, founded by Jesus Christ, built on the confession of Peter. That he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, founded, on the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit gives birth and life to the church. That is eternal. That goes on forever. But I think this American phenomenon of nonprofit voluntary organizations that are created around certain doctrinal formulations, I think those days are over. Okay, so it's going to be interesting to see what comes next. And a lot of people, a lot of historians are conjecturing what may be next. And that's a whole nother conversation. But for me, to your point, I'm not a Lutheran first. I'm a pastor in the one holy Christian and apostolic church first and foremost. That's how I identify myself. Luther is kind of important for some theological emphases, but I don't see my Lutheranism as a cause for division from other sisters and brothers who believe in their heart that Jesus is Lord and confess him with their mouths and are saved. And we are sisters and brothers. So just to be clear in terms of my own ecclesiology. But I am a liturgical Christian. Liturgy is really interesting because liturgy, because of its repetition, serves to ingrain on the soul what the soul at times cannot itself speak or say. And so it's really interesting to me, for example, when I am with older people who are suffering from dementia and they are not remembering their name or who the other people in the room are. And then you pray an ancient prayer with them or something that they have prayed in worship, and it all comes back to them. It's stunning how that works because it's ingrained on their very being. So I think that's one of the powerful advantages of liturgical worship. The downside, of course, is when it becomes simply rote, mechanistic,
ritualistic.
Yeah. Ritual is good. Ritualism is not good. Sure. So that's, that's the downside. And some people turn it into that. But that's not what the purpose of liturgy is. The purpose of liturgy, to the point of our question, and now I'm going to connect our topic to what you're saying. So everybody's got liturgy. The only question is, do you have good liturgy or bad liturgy? Or do you have liturgy that's been tested through time, or a liturgy that you're just kind of making up on the spot? Now, in the American ethos, there is a sense, and I'd love to have it'd be great to have another speaker on here, and we can maybe even have some dialogue, but especially in the West and in the US, there is this sense that which is the most innovative and that which is the newest and the freshest is the best. And so I'm saying that the past matters because we listen to how people in the past prayed and what kind of has been carried through time and through tradition, what's been tested. And in the same way that, I don't know, do you like classic rock? I shouldn't jump to that conclusion. But I'm guessing, you're a Detroiter, Bob Seger's from Detroit.
I actually live really close to Bob Seger. I'm not quite sure where, but it's like within a mile or something. I know that.
That's crazy I brought that up.
Yeah.
So you got Bob Seger, what is classic rock? Okay, classic rock is music that was at one time, top 40, and it survived the test of time. And here we are 50 years later, and they're still playing it. Okay. Yeah. Well, that same principle applies to liturgy, you know, or classic liturgy is here we are so many years later, and we're still singing it because it's proven and it's been tested and it survived through the test of time.
Okay.
Does that address what you're saying?
Yeah, it does. And if I could, I don't know if I summarize it, you know, to my level or whatever, is liturgy in and itself actually isn't the value. The value in liturgy is what it ingrains in us, in the truth that it instills. Maybe I didn't say that right. I'm looking at your face.
No, that's exactly right. So, I mean, liturgy. Okay, so a part of the liturgy is called formally the Kyrie eleison. What is that? It's simply the prayer, Lord, have mercy.
Yeah.
That's an ancient prayer. You can't ever go wrong with that prayer. Every tradition can pray that prayer, Lord, have mercy. Okay, so some are more formal when they pray that prayer. Others are more informal and ecstatic when they just shout out, Lord, have mercy.
I love being in a liturgical setting in a church when I feel like the liturgy is an expression of what the congregation is feeling and the minister is presenting. I don't like liturgy when I feel like they're going through emotion because this is what we do.
Liturgy is not about a book. You see, one of the things that goes wrong about liturgy is some people, again, in this modern age, think that the liturgy is about speaking the words out of a book in the right order at the right time. And that's not what good liturgy is. That's not good worship. Reading out of a book is not good worship. Liturgy has to do with the shape of our worship as God speaks to us and we speak back to God, God's own word. So I know that's not our topic today, but it does pertain to the topic, namely because when you talk about liturgy, you're talking about something that's historic and has been handed down. And the value of tradition is it means that you just may not be the smartest person who has lived in the history of the world. And there just might be the case that someone who lived before you knows more than you about something. You could call it ancestral wisdom. You know, and liturgy is just ancestral wisdom in worship. Okay. So, think about things that your mother or father or grandparents said to you that echo in your mind.
Once a man, twice a baby.
There you go.
That's from my dad. It's from my dad's dad.
Yeah.
What you sow is what you reap. I've got
there a handful of it. See, this is how the past matters. You see, these things that they said were true and they should be handed down. You ought to tell your children and grandchildren and those who come after you, and young people who you mentor, you ought to share this kind of ancestral wisdom. And I think we've lost that in our penchant for the immediate and for the sensational, and for that which tantalizes and titillates us. I think we've lost some of that. There's a poet named T.S. Eliot. He was an American, born in 1888 in St. Louis, Missouri, died in England in 1965. So he dies in 1965, Ken, which is before the rise of, before Al Gore invented the internet.
Right.
Yeah, he dies in 1965, before Apple, before even, what was that other one called? BlackBerry, even before that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And he says this. He says, where is the life we have lost in living? And it was so busy living that we've lost life. And then he goes on to say, where is the wisdom? Talking about ancestral wisdom. Where's the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? We've got all this knowledge, you know, all this education, but where's the wisdom among maybe some of our forebears who could neither read nor write, but had a wisdom that they passed on to us and that bears preservation? Then he goes on to say, where is the education or the knowledge We've lost in information. In other words, we live in an information society where you can get, I mean, you can find out anything, anytime. We got like this glut and surfeit of information, but we don't have knowledge on how do you put the facts together and make them work. And even more, we don't have wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what it, I sound like an old person, but with the younger generation, having more knowledge accessible to them than any other time in history, but knowledge doesn't bring wisdom, life does, or ancestral wisdom. So what will the next generation look like that has so much knowledge, but not the wisdom to use it?
So much information and no wisdom to use it. That's exactly right. And this is why churches in 2023 and moving forward need to be intentional about thinking about intergenerational ministry. How are they intentionally connecting old people like us with these young guys, man, these teens and these 20-somethings who are clueless?
Hey, I don't have 11 grandkids, so let's back up a little bit.
Well, yeah. But you got to be intentional about, building those connections in your ministry.
Yes.
And in your life, because they're not going to happen otherwise.
There's a Saturday Bible study, just men's. A dozen people or less I started going to recently. And what I love about it, there's always more you can learn from scripture, but when you've been studying it your whole life, you're not expecting a great new revelation, but you go. But what I get the most out of it and I enjoy is that there's a former Baptist minister there of an elderly age. There's several older men than me. There's like some of me there. And then there's like young bucks that are getting their first place. They're not married yet, that are actually listening to each other. And the young ones are listening to the older guy's wisdom. You rarely see that. Like here, young man, is how, don't do what I did.
That's it. Don't do it. See, this is why the past matters.
Yeah.
You can avoid some of the traps. And I love the word you talked about, the traumas.
And are you taking notes in what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're good, Ken. I mean, the trials and traumas. The trials and traumas. See, the first time I quote you, I say, Ken McMullen has said.
Right.
And then I say the That's quote. Right. And then the second time I say, as I've previously said, because it's true. I
have right. That's right.
And then it becomes mine. See?
That's right.
But no. But the trials and the traumas that we experience don't need to be repeated and replicated. Why can't we learn? This is why the past matters more than we may think. Why can't we learn from some of the wisdom, again, ancestral wisdom, that which is passed on? This is what communities do best. I'm an academic, but I don't trust ideologies. I don't trust ideologies. I don't trust theories, because they're not connected to people and communities. I'm very active in trying to connect the gospel to the social life of communities, but I don't trust activists.
Right.
Because activists are more concerned about getting attention to their activism than they are to the problem that they claim they're trying to address. So sorry for getting political on you, but this is why this communitarian approach, this community where we gather in these communities. Hey, Ken, I'll be at leading a retreat for men at Adrian College in March. I'll send you the QR code for it. Yes. It'd be fabulous if you could join us. It would be really cool. I shouldn't be doing this live, but it'd be really cool if you could set up and if we could do a little thing from the men's retreat.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about it for sure. I've never gone on the road, but hey, I got to get out,
Yeah. You've got a great format here. And, maybe you might hear something during the retreat that strikes you as interesting. And you could maybe get a little panel discussion even going with someone.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I have a hard time keeping up with you. I don't know if I could keep up with a few of you at the same time. Need an interpreter.
There you go with your flattery. That's the charisma I'm talking about.
So let's circle it and close it back with, is this too simplistic to say, or can you elaborate, or would this thought help people? Is if you have If you're a Christian and you think, well, someone suggests I need therapy, I'm not getting past this issue, this divorce, or I had trauma when I was a child, or whatever it is, and it's just kind of dragging along in your life. And maybe someone has even said, you know what, you probably need to talk to somebody. You're like, man, I'm a new creation. You know, church tells me, behold, I'm new. Everything's in the past. Is it fair to say to this person, you know what, if you broke your leg, would you just get up and keep walking on it and ignore that you have a pain and something's broken? Or is it just as wise and therefore even spiritual to say, I need to go to a professional or somebody, and I need to get this properly taken care of so that it can heal properly, and it may take time, and that's not a bad thing?
So let me start with Jesus, because when in doubt, go to Jesus, right? That's always the right answer, right?
Good go-to.
So the resurrected Jesus in his glorified body, okay? So you have a guy who's got a perfect resurrected body, still has wounds that are scars now on the imprint of his hands and his fissured feet and one in the side. He carries those scars even in his resurrected body. So even in our redeemed selves, we can still carry scars from our previous life.
Emotional scars.
Emotional scars. Relational scars. Things that people have done to us that we just can't shake. I was with a book group last night, and there was a woman there in her 70s. And when she was 17 and a senior in high school, someone told her that she would never be a good writer. And she says her whole life she's wanted to be a writer. And this is echoed in her head. We carry these things, even in our redeemed selves, we carry these things. I want to say there's two ways that I recommend people deal with these things. And one is therapy. There is a place and a role for Christian therapy. So I think it's a false notion among some churches where they say, once you're redeemed, you don't need therapists, you don't need experts, you don't need, to your point around, if you have a broken leg, even Jesus carries scars in his resurrected self. And we're not Jesus, that's for sure. So, and our redemption isn't perfect, isn't complete until heaven. So while we're in this life, I do recommend for some people therapy. However, I also recommend spiritual direction, taking time to cultivate your spiritual life, whether it's on retreats, and men need to be more real about this, you know, realizing that, you know, because men are, you know, men, we tend to behave as if we don't have any issues, we don't have any problems, and we push them on the inside and don't deal with them. Men need to be much more serious about this, but we all do. To carve out time and space where we can extract the clutter in order to hear God new as God speaks to us about the future that he has in mind for us.
Perfect. All right, Dr. Nunes, it's always a pleasure.
The delight and joy are mine. Ken, thanks for doing what you do, brother.
Counted among the outlaws, he said, come follow me. People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.